CliffCentral.com.
CliffCentral.com on a Thursday morning. We're going to get to the burning platform in a moment or two. But before we get to that, a lot of people have been complaining since Ben left the show, which is now a couple of months ago, that we just completely ignore sport. So one of the things that Mbulelo can actually do, because this is one of the things he likes to do, is just to keep us up to date. So before we get to the burning platform brought to you by Nando's, let's go to Mbulelo Tinta, who's got some sport for us. What do you got?
So this could be part of the burning platform. I mean, the CSA are at it again, Gareth. Two more saucy issues.
This is such a disaster.
These guys, I told you they're not fit to run a bath. No. Forget an organization.
Exactly.
Right, so the players' rights, obviously, we all know about rights if you work in the game. They were sold to a fantasy app game in India without the permission, the written permission of the players and the association, right? The Cricketers mm-hmm. Association.
Mm-hmm.
And they promised to pay the association money last year, right?
Yeah.
Gareth, that was last year, and they only paid it at the end of November, including money for the MSL, which is the Mzansi Super League.
Why is cricket such a disaster? Just can someone explain this to me? What is it that's going on there? Because we know that, you know, there's been corruption in rugby. We know that there was stuff going on about 2 years ago that made the headlines, where it came to Saru and their own goings on. But cricket, it seems, is almost consistently involved in something dodgy, whether it's internationally or locally.
You know, it's because of where the market is, Gareth. It's it's always the criminals are ahead of the organization, and cricket's quite amateur, relatively speaking. And it's always the gambling, right? Where there's major gambling, there's big problems. And if we're honest, in this case, India is such a big market, and you know most of the gambling happens there. It's illegal, and it happens sort of under the radar, and it's almost impossible to keep an eye on that type of thing. And quite frankly, world cricket is run by a guy who I'm not a big fan of, former wicketkeeper Dave Richardson. He's a bit of a softy, so he doesn't keep an eye on things. But it's and then in our country, it's a bunch of losers. We've already spoken about that. Anyway, 2.5 million rand, Gareth, that they should have paid last year. They only paid the players now. And we've got the biggest series coming up, right? In years, probably 4 or 5 years, in England are coming here. We still don't have a selection panel we know about. Our players have no idea whether they're going to be in the team or not. No one knows who's going to be in the team. And my favorite part of this whole debacle, Gareth, is the chief commercial officer, Kugandri Govinda, is saying, we've tried to engage the Players Association, and it's not our intention to shortchange anybody that needs to be compensated, least of all our own players. Mm-hmm. Dude, you haven't paid guys their commercial rights, so you've tried to cheat them twice, what, the app and the Mzansi Super League rights? And right. Then you're saying, you know, like, come on, you know, that
sounds rotten to the core.
Do you know, it's like a husband who cheats on his wife, and then when she catches him, it's like, oh no, it's your fault. It's your fault that you caught me, or it's your fault that you don't love me. That's basically what Kugandri's saying. You've been caught with your pants down, and you are a clown.
All right.
And then just a little bit
Anything
of football.
Else you want to throw
yeah,
in?
Let's talk a little bit about football. Last night, Jose Mourinho returned to Old Trafford. Gareth, quickly, you know when you break up with somebody, you always hope to see them at the shops, right? And hopefully your new girlfriend is a lot better than...
Yeah, there's that thing that when you see an ex, you want to look better than them, and they must be better than you.
Exactly. Maybe they've put on a little...
They mustn't be better than
you. Yeah. Hopefully they've put on a bit of weight, and they're dating maybe a fat guy or whatever. That's what Jose Mourinho was hoping yesterday, right? He took back his Tottenham team. He was fired from Man United less than a year ago. He's now a Tottenham manager. Went back to Old Trafford yesterday. Didn't quite go according to plan. Man United beat Tottenham 2-1 last night, and now Man United are up to the dizzying heights of sixth place. They're only 22 points off the lead. And so they sort of back in action. Didn't go according to plan for Jose. And Liverpool won 5-2, and they are 8 points ahead of Leicester. So we'll keep an eye on that. The Everton manager getting sacked very, very soon.
Ooh, okay. Exciting stuff. It is time for more exciting stuff with the Burning Platform. Every week we cover a bunch of the most important current affairs, the things that people are talking about, the things that you might be required to have an opinion on at the office. And sometimes you're ill-equipped for this. I know it happens to me. Sometimes people come in and like, what do you think of this? And you think, oh God, I don't know that. I don't know what to say about this. I'm not sure I want to have an opinion on this. This is dangerous territory. Well, we cover this for you. And this morning, we've got a huge spate of interesting stories to get to, from local scenes, international happenings. And to make sense of this, we have our resident commentator, Canthan Pillay, also an anarcho-capitalist, formerly a libertarian, formerly a socialist. This is going to be interesting. Mpia Ketlameni. How are you, sir?
I am good, and yourself?
Very nice to have you here for the first time.
Yeah, no, I'm glad to be here.
I think that you and Canton are going to agree about some things and disagree about just a very few, but it'll be interesting to see which is which.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about you and Piak here before we get into the burning platform. I believe you describe yourself as a Zulu anarchist who correctly believes that taxation is theft.
Yes, I think a lot of people have described me as a Zulu anarchist. I am Zulu, I am an anarchist, but it's just become a thing on the internet.
Well, that's a rare thing because we don't have a lot of Zulu anarchists in the country.
Right, yes. So, yeah, it's, I suppose in terms of my history, it's just going to, where would I start? I've been self-taught in a lot of things, been curious about things, sort of chased my curiosity, and that's how I came to anarchy as well. I was just chasing my curiosity, trying to be logical, thinking through things for myself, and then, yeah, that's how I came to these ideas. And
In this political scene in South Africa, people don't really like it, especially the politicians, when you think for yourself. It yes. tends to make you enemies rather than friends in the political yeah. scene. So do you belong to a party? Are you against all of them? Do you argue vociferously on social media against politics yeah. of so every kind?
I sort of see party politics as a terrible way of defending yourself, but it is a way of defending yourself. And so earlier this year, I voted ZACP just because...
So you then know, you know Canton,
yes.
right? Okay.
So that just because it was the best way I thought of defending myself against an ever-encroaching state. And so that's... But anarchists, they tend to go into politics rather unwillingly just because, you know, as soon as people want to go into politics, then we're sort of suspicious of why...
I mean, I think that probably it's a good position to yeah. assume... that we should be no,
but
suspicious.
But the Capitalist Party was pretty good. It's something that South Africa has never seen, something like that. So that was interesting, being involved with some of the people who were involved in that and seeing how the whole campaign progressed and how much traction was gotten there. And so it was interesting, and there was a lot of hope for the first time for many of us who had sort of just given up on party politics. And so that was interesting.
This is interesting. I'm afraid, Canton, we're going to be accused this morning of being very one-sided if you and Piake agree on so many things. But let's get into some of the events
well,
of the week.
Well, there's clearly a Venn diagram of Zulus and anarchists and capitalists. And
do you think so?
And so I don't fit into the middle of the Venn diagram because, you know, obviously, I'm an honorary Zulu.
Mm-hmm. But tell me about this Venn diagram. Do you really think there's a relationship between Zulus and anarcho-capitalism?
No, but it would be a good thing.
So that's wishful thinking on your part. All right, let's get into some things, guys. The new Joburg mayor, let's start with that. The ANC's Jeff Makubo has been elected the new mayor of the city of Johannesburg. He has a past, which the DA has been referring to over and over again, but it's not like they offered anyone who was totally convincing, and neither did the EFF. Do we have any comments on our new mayor, Jeff Makubo?
I think the fascinating thing for me about Jeff Makubo is, well, first and foremost, is that the ANC's Integrity Commission says, no, hang on a second, this guy's not off the hook yet. So we'll have to wait and see what pronouncements actually come from there. The second thing that's going to be of interest to me is how Makubo actually manages to run the city going forward. And this is actually, I think we should view this in a positive light. Let me tell you why.
Yeah.
Because essentially he doesn't have a majority to pass through any legislation. So, you know, he got elected on the basis of having a plurality. But in order to pass legislation, you need my understanding of the way in which the rules of the city council actually work. He'll need to get 50% plus one seat in favor of any attempt to pass any ordinances in the city council. So if he wants to pass a budget, for example,
he's going to be stuck the whole time.
He's going to be stuck unless the stuff that's in the budget has sufficient support from the other parties, which is a good thing.
Well, it seems the EFF are certainly publicly backing him. Maybe that's where the votes that he needs will come from.
Well, you see, again, what's interesting is that, you see, the EFF didn't back him in the actual elections. And I think that the EFF have now realized that, wait a second, we thought we were kingmakers, and in fact we are not. And so now there's the scramble to say, well, you know, we've got to align ourselves with one side or the other. But I think that, you know, the interesting position now is that in order for Makubo to pass anything, in, you know, and particularly we're talking about spending, which is the most crucial thing that all of us as ratepayers actually worry about. If Makubo wants to be spending ratepayers' money, he's going to need to get backing on that expenditure from either the DA or the EFF.
Do you think that he's going to be stuck in constant quarrels trying to find support and that he's going to basically
I think that's a lame duck? No, I think that this is where he's actually going to be forced to make compromises.
And that might not be a bad thing?
That's a great thing. That's actually a great thing.
Well, what do you have to say about this in Mpiyake? Because you don't like party politics, but this is how things are governed. And the city of Johannesburg has had an ANC mayor before, then it had a DA mayor. And spectacularly, Herman Mashaba resigned, and he doesn't want anything to do with the DA anymore. Now we've got this guy. You are resident in Johannesburg?
Oh, yes, I am now, since last year, end of last year.
So what do you care about? What do you actually want from a mayor?
Well, I would like to see robots that work, for one. I mean, ever since I've been in Joburg, there's one particular robot near work that is always off. It's never working. And now this has been 12 months or more that I've been in Johannesburg. I don't know how...
I feel your pain.
I don't know how people allow this to happen, but it does happen. I mean, the roads are in a terrible state in many areas. And so just the basics. I would like to see people actually do local government basics and just, you know, do their job that we pay them to do instead of trying to do all of this other stuff. And in terms of the other stuff that they talk about being pro-poor and all of this, well, that might be the rhetoric. But if you look at things like how they treat informal street traders, foreign migrants and all of these things, then you see that these people across parties, by the way, are not pro-poor at all.
No, yeah. It seems to me that that's just a lot of hot air because we see street vendors, people are trying to operate little businesses to feed their families, keep themselves alive, make a little bit of money.
I actually disagree with Mpiyake because they certainly are pro-poor. It's just that they happen to be custodians of the wealth of the poor.
Hmm. Canton, again, there's just no generosity of spirit there. So I'm trying to figure out who's the biggest anarcho-capitalist of the two of you. By the way, for those who want to know, Mpiyake Dlamini also is a writer for The Rational Standard and Business Day. He's also a programmer and works for the Free Market Foundation in South Africa. And he posts about liberty on Facebook as a way of avoiding the frequent bugs in his code, which I think is interesting. Let's turn our attention away from the Joburg mayor and look at a situation where Ridi Tlabi has submitted an application to give evidence and cross-examine Jacob Zuma after accusing the former president of making 7 false and defamatory comments about her. First of all, I really like Ridi Tlabi because I think she is a woman of integrity. She's someone who, when faced by threats, all kinds of ugly threats against her, first of all as a woman and second of all as someone who's outspoken and who's a journalist and who's been very much at the forefront of bringing some semblance of justice to the woman who was maligned during the Jacob Zuma rape trial and who was ignored and who was, you know, basically bundled off and sent away. She's done a very brave thing here, and now she's taking it to the next level because she's gone to the State Capture Commission and they have directed former President Jacob Zuma to file written submissions to oppose or comment on the application by Ridi Tlabi to cross-examine him. What do we think of this?
I'm pulling up a chair.
You're going to watch?
Yes, gathering popcorn, and I'm looking forward to it. Yeah, it's going to be fun.
I mean, Ridi's really smart, so if she does end up having the chance to do what all of us would like to do, she's probably going to savor that and make it really exciting.
I think very much so. Remember that... Because it's essentially equivalent to giving testimony in open court. Mm-hmm. You know, you can ask questions that would otherwise be considered to be
cheeky and rude and wrong,
or even, you know, outright defamatory, as the former president has gotten away with by accusing his comrades of being apartheid era spies and so forth. And so the gloves are off before Judge Zondo. And the thing that I like about Judge Zondo is that he's very considered before he actually intercedes at any level. So he'll generally allow people to continue to ramble on. And then he'll suddenly ask this very incisive single question. In fact, if you want a good understanding of what's going on at state capture, generally the way in which to follow it is to look for the rare occasions when Judge Zondo actually speaks. And that gives you pointers as to where this thing is going.
Do you think the whole thing is being run as well as possible? Because, you give credit to him, but essentially this commission of inquiry has no teeth. And it's allowing us to figure out what happened, and we're getting testimony from a bunch of different people. And obviously he'll publish his findings at the end of this, but then it's up to the prosecutors to get involved.
It's up to the NPA.
Yeah. Shamila Batoy, so far, we haven't had a lot of people jumping up and down saying she's fantastic.
No, but again, you and I have discussed the logistics of the NPA needing to get their own house in order. Now, as we saw, when was it, yesterday or was it the day before, that Parliament confirmed the ousting of two of Zuma's acolytes who were part of the ANC. This is Mrebi and Jiba. So
that took a long time.
It took a long time, but it ties in exactly with the point that I was making, that she's got to actually do this purge of people within the ranks of the NPA before she's in a position to actually, put down a docket without it being leaked immediately to the perpetrators. The thing about Bongo, though, is kind of interesting.
Yeah, that was a major move.
Yes, that was a major move. And so I think that maybe, and again, this is just being hopeful, maybe this is the thin edge of the wedge, and we'll start to see more of these flowing from this point onwards.
Are you feeling similarly hopeful?
I've been following the State Capture Commission as sort of like a political drama. What I don't understand in this entire thing is that, okay, since there's so much evidence that seems to be coming out, then why is it taking the prosecution service in this country, firstly? Secondly, why is there only one prosecution service? I mean, who are we supposed to benchmark the NPA against if evidence is evidence and anyone should be able to bring evidence in court and accuse someone else of a crime and sort of present that evidence? So if we had something like that, out of all the allegations coming out of the State Capture Commission, surely some private prosecution agency would have taken those up now and taken them to court, just because there's such a there's a huge volume of what's coming out, and it things are being revealed and nothing is happening, which seems very strange. It seems like someone who should have an interest in sort of getting to the bottom of this, unraveling some of these issues, but no one seems to care. It just goes on.
Well, there's breaking news going on at the moment, in a media statement by Minister Pravin Gordhan about SAA that I'd like to have your thoughts on. And if there's anything that we need anarcho-capitalists for, it's to help us unbundle and sort out SAA. Let's just talk about the statement. So here it is. Uh-huh. This is the official media statement by the minister. On Sunday, I announced government's intention to introduce a radical restructuring process at SAA in order to ensure its financial and operational sustainability. Over the past 2 days, the government has taken the necessary steps that pave the way to an orderly and methodical restructuring process. In line with our broad strategic vision, I'd like to announce the following. The board of SAA has adopted a resolution to place the company into business rescue. It's a big decision. The decision is supported by government. This is the optimal mechanism to restore confidence in SAA and safeguard the good assets of the company and help to restructure and position the entity into one that is stronger, more sustainable, and able to grow and attract an equity partner. Wow. Finally, decision.
Yes, absolutely. And what's fascinating is that the statement actually was finally released at about 2 o'clock this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Was when the statement finally dropped. So obviously there's been lots of discussion that's been going on behind the scenes around this.
Yeah.
And of course, what's kind of interesting is that today is the day that Solidarity was going to be taking government to court
So it's just in time.
So yes, it is preempted, and I think it's a good thing that it was preempted, because otherwise it becomes a question of solidarity has forced the government's hand. I think that this is better than a bailout. So, you know, I think that what's happened up until now is that government has written checks and the money has gone down into a sinkhole. And the thing about actually putting SAA into business rescue is, firstly, it allows them to avoid a scenario where there's a rush of people wanting to liquidate the airline for payment of debts. Mm-hmm. So it actually gives them breathing room to get their house in order. And then secondly, it's also a very clear rebuttal to the idiocy of the likes of NUMSA, you know, who...
But it's a victory for Tito and for Praveen in this case, who have really been forced to... They've been forced to deal with unions. They've been forced to deal with the NEC within the ANC, who have very differing opinions about what's going on over there.
Yeah, I think, you know, calling it a victory, I think...
Is that too much?
Yeah, I think this is kind of an ongoing battle. And I think that this round definitely, it would appear that that Praveen and Tito... And here's what's interesting, you know...
And then in the background, Cyril.
Yeah, in the background, Cyril. But, you know, what's really interesting to me is, if you've been watching comments in Parliament over the past... couple of days, yeah. Whenever Minister Gordhan has been speaking, he has been making very close reference to his friend, the Minister of Minerals and Energy Affairs, Gwede Mantashe.
Why?
Well, I don't know. You know, someone, I think it was Andy Makanana on Twitter, was saying, hey guys, there's a bit of a bromance brewing out here. But I think that that's an interesting back current, because, you know, I would actually have assumed that those two would be on opposite sides of the fence, but now they seem to be speaking with one voice. Is this a good thing? Well, it's certainly better than having them at each other's throats on this particular issue.
Wow, what do you think of that? You want to join in here, Mbulelo? You seem like you have a lot to say.
No, I was the only way you know whether you're in Gwede's good books. I was going to say, has he given him one of those leather jackets yet? Then I'll know.
Yeah, I mean, it does sound to me like this is some progress. It's progress of a kind, right?
Yes, very much so. It's I think that, again, from the what would be interesting is to get a sense of what the markets look like this morning. You know, the Rand is going to be the most immediate indicator in terms of whether this is a good thing or not. And if you consider that after the medium-term budget speech, the Rand, you know, promptly tanked from 14.50 to well over 15 to the dollar.
Right.
Interestingly, it had actually regained that loss up until about a day or so ago. And the question is whether it's going to actually now get a bit of a boost on the back of this thing.
You think it'll rally a little bit?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, well, let's see what happens.
The markets are generally quite receptive to things when that actually look like it's real action.
I mean, Piake, what would you have liked to have seen happen to SAA if you were in charge there now?
So I hope I need to understand the business rescue process a little bit better for myself. But as long as this doesn't this ends the continued liability that the South African taxpayer that had to contend with, I will be happy. So the last thing that we are supposed to be liable for would be the 9.2 billion in government guaranteed debt. So that will still need to be paid regardless. But after that, if there are no other liabilities after that, then personally, I would be happy in terms of the taxpayers continuing to fund something that had clearly shown itself to have failed.
I think the interesting shift that we've had in the discourse from the ANC point of view, by the way, is the very real case that has been made that if all the money that had been poured into SAA had instead been poured into PRASA for upgrading Metrorail, that would have had a significant impact on the lives of the poorest of the poor in this country who make use of that method of transport. And instead, subsidizing SAA is basically subsidizing rich people.
Yeah.
You know, those of us who fly.
No, and right. I thought it was such a genius move. I think it was Minister Tito Mboweni during his medium-term budget who first said this. It was such a genius move on his part to sort of change the narrative.
Yes.
Instead of seeing this as an privatization and getting rid of SAA as an anti-poor or anti-worker policy, see it as a pro-poor, pro-worker policy, which is what it is.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's quite right. And it's a smart spin on the story from Tito Mboweni. Okay, well, I'm sorry to have to go back into the mire of local party politics and in this case, Tshwane. But we've seen this story, and I don't know that this is a real story. But, you know, over and over again, we've had to hear about the pretty ugly mental image that is conjured up of Stephen Mokgalapa. Who is, I mean, he and this woman who's supposed to have been the MEC, or the MMC as it is, for transport in the Tshwane government with him, the two of them had a bit of an affair. I don't know, there are allegations that there are videos being sent around and audio recordings of these two sexting or chatting each other up. And it's become a bit of a hot potato for them. But I actually just think that in any of these situations, the best thing that a politician can do is go, yes, we're doing this. Yes, we had an affair. This happens in workplaces all over the world. Why is it a big deal? Yeah. There's no controversy here. It doesn't in any way affect our work because what we're doing isn't happening in work hours or it's happening during our lunch break or whatever. It's absolutely fine. Why are you people digging around where there isn't anything to be found?
Well, I think the issue is that it took place on the office table, and that's abuse of government property.
But really, do we care about this? And is anyone interested in the sex life of Mayor Mokgalapa?
No, I don't think so. I think it's just a complete sideshow. The fact that this has political people commenting and pundits and all of this is just ridiculous.
I think that more often than not, sex scandals are distractions to avoid the spotlight falling on actual corruption.
Yeah,
I think, you know, really what we need to do is just sweep the sex scandals aside and say, I don't really care who you're sleeping with, but can we get to the bottom of these deals?
Yeah, and especially in Tshwane, where we've had deals about all kinds of fiber providers and internet service providers and people who really have been given huge big contracts and never delivered. There's been a clawback of resources and of financial mismanagement in some ways under this DA government, because of course it was Solly before then. And I think people in Tshwane are mostly happy.
Well,
as opposed to people in Johannesburg.
At one level there's been clawback, at other level there've been dodgy contracts under the DA government as well. And this really is the issue. And the fact is that if you look at a lot of the suburbs of in Tshwane right now, very basic services like water and electricity continue to be literally falling apart because of the fact that infrastructure has not been maintained. You know, so we had the blockading of the R55 by residents of Lodium not so long ago because of the fact that there was no water there, and they had tankers coming and bringing water into the area. And this is an established suburb, and it's really all about the fact that, you know, the infrastructure has not been maintained properly.
Yeah. Can we turn our attentions further afield, overseas? Let's have a look at what's going on in America. There was the NATO summit over the last few days, which, of course, meant everybody gathering together. And really, NATO is just where America tries to get back some of the value that they put in for protecting all these other countries so that they can have social spending instead of military spending. That's what Donald Trump says anyway. Does he have room to move here? And is that a fair assessment that America has basically paid for the security of Europe?
Well, ask yourself, the security of Europe from whom? Because, you know, the fact of the matter is that if there happened to be a war between Europe and, well, Russia, effectively, it's the only real kind of threat that, and again, I use threat very, with my tongue firmly in cheek, because there's no way in hell that Putin actually wants to start any sort of conflict with these guys. But the fact is that in the absence of the US, Europe would win.
Oh, really? So they don't need
No, I don't think so. I mean, if
NATO is an old world of the relic of the Cold War.
If you just consider that, just France and the UK and Germany between them are actually, you know, capable of toppling most governments around the world with minimum effort on their part. So the more interesting thing for me is they're trying to reconcile the fact that.
Because that's not what people are saying, Canton. I know mean, that's when not I say people, I mean there are a lot of people in the left in the U.S. who say that NATO is an essential part of American foreign policy, that essentially Europe and other free parts of the world, free in inverted commas, would not be able to maintain their freedoms without U.S. Largesse and protection. You're saying that that's not true. These countries could almost individually take on any major threat and successfully repel it.
Yes, because the only threats that are likely to come right now essentially are from two places, which is from Russia or the U.S.
Okay, all right.
Now,
let's talk about
before Piake comes in. The real issue for me is the hypocrisy of allowing Turkey to actually, run with the hares and hunt with the hounds. Because, the issue, of course, was that Turkey has bought the S-400 missile defense system from Russia, which really got Trump upset. And now suddenly Trump is turning around and saying, well, no, actually, Erdogan's my bro.
Well, we know what's really going on there. We know that Trump is looking to man up against the other big strongmen. And Erdogan is one of those, and he also wants to sort out Syria.
Yeah, but I think
tangentially,
I think crucially, that for the first time, NATO has actually touched on the subject of China. That for me is a very interesting thing, because NATO was always talking about the former Soviet bloc. It was essentially a Cold War relic.
Well, I was going to ask you, when you say there are only two possible threats.
Yes,
I mean China is not an interventionist military state like it maybe wanted to be once.
Absolutely not. But if you look in terms of sheer military muscle, China now is the second largest spender on defense in the entire world.
In fact, there was a U.S. contract that was approved just this week, $22 billion, in order to get some submarines that can compete with the Chinese, effectively. That's pure military spending. That's the U.S. flexing its muscle and also taking part in some kind of an arms race with China.
Sorry, I'm chuckling because I suddenly remember that headline recently. U.S. suspects Chinese are hiding submarines underwater.
Do you want to add anything to this?
Sorry, I just wanted to say that in terms of the U.S. government spending on their military, just how the sheer size of it, I think you sort of have to think that there's something going on there. And as much as Trump might complain about NATO, I think a lot of corporations which are really just welfare queens in the USA are happy that the USA is involved in all of these things, because they get to extract money from the state, the taxpayers of the US. And so this all of these things are also just, if you peel behind the surface, you don't sort of think why should there be so much conflict. Like, for example, NATO, it's been involved in a lot of tension with Russia. But if you look at the members of NATO in Europe, a lot of them have trade links with Russia and they're okay with Russia. They accept their oil and Russia accepts their money. And so why is there a conflict there?
It's almost like they're putting up a fight that nobody really wants to get involved in.
Yes.
It's like they're spoiling, but nobody's actually going to throw a punch.
The really interesting war is not the military war. The really interesting war is the trade war. And
Talking specifically about the U.S.-Chinese trade war?
Well, if you look in terms of the Trump now threatening 100% tariff on all French goods, if the French end up taxing Facebook and Google, because he's basically saying we have the right to tax American companies, you don't.
So that's what's going on under the surface.
That's what's going on under the surface. But remember my other axiom as well, that all wars are trade wars.
Well, here's some interesting stuff in connection with this that I'd like your comments on. The impeachment investigation into Donald Trump has entered a new phase. The public testimony by four experts on constitutional law comes one day after the House Intelligence Committee laid out the case for removing Mr. Trump. The intelligence panel's report said evidence of Mr. Trump's misconduct was overwhelming. If impeachment passes in the House, the U.S. Senate will then bring on a trial. The White House has denied allegations made by the Democrats that Trump has put his own personal political interests above the national interests of the United States by soliciting foreign interference in the 2020 elections, as the 300-page report argues. Now, after that, White House spokeswoman Stephanie Grisham said it was utterly a failure and they'd produced no evidence of wrongdoing. Speaking from London, Mr. Trump called the Democratic effort unpatriotic. What do we think of this? Have the Democrats lost this battle? Is it over? People are losing interest in it?
Well, let's talk about the fact that Kamala Harris has withdrawn from the presidential race.
Is that related, or are you just avoiding my question?
No, I think that, it's actually more relevant to what's going on in the U.S. You know, we've had this discussion about impeachment ad nauseum, really. And fundamentally, what it comes down to, impeachment is not going to pass in the Senate. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to happen. So anything that happens around this impeachment debate is going to be a sideshow.
But do you agree with either Trump's comment that it's unpatriotic, or that the Stephanie Grisham comment that they've totally failed? Or do you agree with the Democratic point of view that this is, there's evidence of wrongdoing and putting personal interests ahead of everything else? It doesn't matter to you at all?
It doesn't matter to me at all. Well, look, if you want me to drill down into the only thing that they really have against him, which is this this conversation in terms of Ukraine, which...
You're talking about the phone call with the Ukrainian president.
Exactly. And if you drill down to the legalities of that, they'd be hard-pressed to be able to show intent to actually commit an injustice against his opponent, simply because of the fact that similar concerns had been raised by the previous administration, by the Obama administration.
Well, don't we also have ample evidence that, if anything, the Russian collusion hoax has been put to bed?
Yes, but that's
Hillary Clinton, if anybody, was soliciting Ukrainian help in trying to find information about Donald Trump prior to the 2016 elections.
Yes, but but Saint Hillary can't be touched. You know this. But no, seriously, let's talk about what the real issues are. Impeachment is never going to pass through the Senate. So no matter what ends up coming out of this, frankly, I think
lawyers call it moot.
Yes, it is moot.
It's a theoretical thing.
Yes, it's a theoretical framework. And, do we think that Trump is a jerk? I'm the type of person who thinks, yes, Trump is a jerk. Do I think he's a smart jerk? Yes, I do. The more crucial thing for me is what's going to happen in terms of the build-up to the elections. Now Trump threw an interesting thing into the mix last week, where he basically told China, well, we're not going to have a trade deal until the elections are over.
What do you have to say about
that? So I would say, in terms of the legalities of it, there might be something there, just because of what I've read from Andrew Napolitano and also Justin Amash, two libertarians in the USA, who I respect, because I don't know enough about the law and how it works, their constitution. But from the arguments they've been making to me, it seems to be, because remember, impeachment is not a criminal trial, so it's there's a lower standard of proof and what you need to show.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there is a chance there. But I think Kanzan is right in the sense that it will be a political matter where it passes in the Senate. But I think, as things stand now, it will definitely not pass. The Senate wouldn't prosecute just because the economy is going so well. So the unknown factor is here. What happens if there is a recession? If some of the indicators we've been seeing, and something actually happens in 2020, early in 2020, or maybe towards the middle of the year?
But people have been warning about this recession, and now we're seeing even higher stock market returns. We're seeing even less unemployment. So it seems that at the moment, those factors are in Trump's favor.
Recessions never happen when everyone expects them. It's just the rule of recessions. It will happen when everyone is complacent and say, okay, this was just the sky is falling, people are just shouting, nothing is happening, and then all of a sudden, boom. And so if a recession happens enough that Republicans will want to distance themselves from the Trump economy, if that happens, then we might see a prosecution after the House has we might see a conviction in the Senate.
All right, so that's Trump dealt with. What's going on with Boris? Any updates on that?
And the situation there? I think the crucial thing is that Boris told Trump, very politely, look, please, please, please don't interfere in our elections. I don't want an endorsement from you. I don't want anything of the sort. Just like stay away.
Because he's toxic in the UK.
Yes. Very much so.
Yeah, they don't like him, even if they're conservative.
Yeah, well, no. I think that's not really so much of an issue. It's just that it'll become too much of a wedge issue for Boris if he has to defend himself against a Trump endorsement with the really vociferous grouping that, you know, support the likes of Corbyn.
But Jeremy Corbyn's had a horrible week. And maybe we should just spend a second on him, because he's just been given so many opportunities to apologize for very anti-Semitic things that have been going on in his party, anti-Semitic comments he's been making. A lot of people on the left are trying to explain that away by saying Corbyn is critical of Israel, but he's not anti-Semitic. And sometimes, you know, there are theories that those two things are the same thing. If you are critical of Israel, which is a Jewish state, it's usually because you have a different standard for Israel than you do for all its neighbors, which is often true. Or that, in fact, there are two separate arguments going on here, that you could be critical of Israel and have contempt for Israeli policy and Israeli foreign policy and Israeli attitudes, but that you don't have a problem with Jews. And that's what fans of Corbyn try to say. What do you think of that?
I think that the average British voter actually does not give a shit about whether or not Corbyn is anti-Semitic. I think that the average British voter looks at Corbyn and kind of has the sort of disdain that that Clarkson had. You've seen that sketch that was
you're talking about Jeremy Clarkson.
Yes, yeah. Yes. That was during the rounds where, you know,
Kelly Clarkson.
Both are attorneys.
You know, it's the entire point of ABC. Anyone but Corbyn. Because of the fact that, and you know, he harkens to the fact that socialism was tried by Labour in the past and it ended up being an absolute disaster. And along came Thatcher to basically rescue them.
Right. I just want you, while we're on NATO, Trump, Boris, they were all interviewed at the NATO summit. And here's what Donald Trump had to say about Justin Trudeau, which you might find interesting. Listen to this.
He's too fast.
Listen.
Well, he's too fast.
Do you think that Germany is too naive?
And honestly, with Trudeau, he's a nice guy. I find him to be a very nice guy. But, you know, the truth is that I called him out on the fact that he's not paying 2%. And I guess he's not very happy about it. I mean, you were there, a couple of you were there. And he's not paying 2%, and he should be paying 2%. It's Canada, they have money, and they should be paying 2%. So I called him out on that, and I'm sure he wasn't happy about it, but that's the way it is. Look, I'm representing the U.S., and he should be paying more than he's paying, and he understands it. So I can imagine he's not that happy, but that's the way it is.
So he called him two-faced, essentially, for not paying his 2%. Trump does this, though. He forces guys who would otherwise play gentle, friendly politics, like Justin Trudeau, who's really, he's dressed up and pretends to be a prime minister, but honestly, he doesn't have any balls, he doesn't have any teeth, he's not a strong guy, and when Trump calls him out on these kinds of things, where he's shown to be obviously hypocritical, it does damage to Trudeau, it doesn't damage Trump, it makes Trump look, at worst, like he's a horrible person, but people prefer the honesty in a climate of hypocrisy and political correctness, don't they?
I think they do. Well, certainly, you know, American taxpayers, you know, like the idea of Trump standing up to the rest of the world and saying, pay your fair share.
And it makes Trudeau look weak by comparison.
Oh, I don't know about that, because, you know, if one looks at Canadians generally, they are weak by comparison with the U.S. You know, let's be very clear about that. You know, you remember that that Monty Python song, I'm a Lumberjack.
Yes, that's Canadians,
that's
right?
Wonderful song.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
All right, anything you want to add? What's on your mind in terms of let's focus even on our local economy at the moment. We spoke a little bit about SAA, talked about the Rand, but we are coming up to that time of year where people spend money and where next year Tito has to put together some kind of a budget. What are you anarcho-capitalists expecting, best case and worst case scenario?
So my best case scenario is complete collapse.
Really? That's what you would want?
No, that's not what I would want. It's what's going to that's what I'm sort of projecting now because of just how bad.
You mean South a complete Africa's collapse of the economy
in South Africa just because of how
and
bad.
And what the old IMF bailout argument?
I'm not sure if it's going to be IMF because South Africa has still has a lot of good domestic savings and pensions and so on. So that we might not go to the IMF route, but I think all the options have been constricted to so few choices now that government is going to end up doing something horrible for someone anyway, no matter what happens. And you just all you can do now is you can only prepare yourself. And as if that's not enough, then the global economy as well is showing signs of strain. And so we know South Africa, as soon as something a little bit happens to the global economy, South Africa that gets.
What are you doing with your money, Pierre? With this horrible gloomy outlook of yours, what are you doing with your money? Where are you putting it to make it safe?
So I'm trying to avoid, like, ever since the medium-term budgets, I've just tried to reduce my exposure to the South African rand as much as possible. I've taken it out from ETFs in terms of where I am putting it. I've been really attracted by things such as silver and gold. I think that's that's what's going to
the because safety of precious metals.
Because if you look at what's happening globally, normally the dollar would be a good way to hedge against the rand inflation. But now, if you look at what's going to happen to the USA, the fact that we have had essentially four rounds of quantitative easing, then you can't take anything for granted, I think, and you just have to prepare yourself as much as possible. And the traditional safe investments for thousands of years of human history have been silver and gold. So.
Well, what do you think? I mean, are you as depressing as in Piake when it comes to this?
Look, I think from my point of view, the whole idea of having an income that is denominated in currencies other than rands is a good thing in theory, but it's actually kind of difficult to pull off. And, you know, one of the reasons for that is if you look in terms of the U.S. right now, mm-hmm. where you have interest rates that are pretty much close to zero, how do you actually go about, you know, generating returns in those scenarios? Yes, the U.S. stock market is basically flying. And, you know, every week pretty much Trump says, ha, look, we've reached another all-time high in terms of what's happening here. But the fact is that your really huge companies don't end up paying dividends. So, you know, you can sit holding shares in Apple as an example and watch your capital actually increase in value. But the only way that you're really going to draw an income from that is by disposing of those shares, which doesn't really help most of the time. Or on the rare occasions when Apple indulges in a buyback, which...
Do you agree with the precious metals philosophy here that Piake is espousing?
Look, the certainly Putin agrees with that theory. And if you look in terms of the massive amount of gold that Putin has been buying for the longest time now, I think that he's certainly betting against the dollar in the long run, and I'm actually in complete agreement with MPRK on that. This quantitative easing stuff has the U.S. dollar. We've spoken about this before. Is effectively just there because of sentiment. There's nothing really backing it other than the oil price. We've now got a glut of oil in the market, and we've now got Putin and OPEC now sitting down and trying to work out whether it's time to actually turn off the taps again so that they can get prices back up. You've got this really interesting scenario going on where the Europeans are actually pushing ahead to try and salvage the Iran nuclear deal. And they're actually creating a backdoor to allow Europe to trade directly with Iran outside of the U.S. financial system. And again, what that does is that it actually undermines the value of the dollar, which, you know, fundamentally is the reason why you've got the
U.S. So if you were Trump, how would you deal with that?
It's really difficult to bypass it. There's obviously lots of bluster, and, you know, he's got his State Department people saying that, you know, the Europeans are basically undermining the integrity of NATO by, but in spite of the fact that this was unilateral sanctions imposed,
he could keep using NATO as the tool to punish them for talking to Iran.
No.
Maybe you don't think so?
No, not really. Because remember that, yes, everyone contributes his money to NATO, but the reason why the U.S. has the bulk of the expenditure is because the U.S. pays to keep all of those military bases going.
For them, it's a strategic.
In Europe, yes. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, so, you know, okay. if you've got, you know, literally tens of thousands of troops per country around the border with the former Soviet republics, then you can understand why he'd be anxious for the rest of them to be paying their way.
Well, here's just an update from Eleanor. You know, we have very smart people who are paying attention to the detail. Apparently, Trump called Trudeau two-faced because he was caught on camera with Boris and Princess Anne slagging off Trump at a NATO event hosted by the Queen. So Trump is right. Trudeau is a hypocrite. But that's besides the point there from Eleanor. So that's another useful bit of information. And the anybody but Corbyn is also something very much on her mind at the moment. So thank you very much, gents. Good to see you both. And thank you for the updates. We have some useful intel to go into the last day of the week and the rest of our weekend with. So if you want to sound smart, you can always listen to The Burning Platform.
When are we wrapping up for the year, by the way?
We are doing our last one. What is it? 19th, so it's the week just before Christmas.
Ah, the week before Christmas.
And we're going to have the
is this the reunion? Is this the reunion? Pumi finally coming back?
Pumi Mashiko and Canthan Pillay together again on the Burning Platform for the last episode of the year. A family reunion. Where we'll no doubt have some argument.
As I said, you know, my fellow honorees.
Yeah. Well, we don't want to have a situation again where it's just you and Piake agreeing with each other the whole time. We quite like the Burning Platforms where there's snide remarks passed, differences of opinion, ugliness. So maybe we'll have you back in Piake without Canthan.
Whoa. Well, three Zulus in here and then it's a, then it's a taxi ride.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Thank you all very much. The Burning Platform, as every week, brought to you by Nando's. They're not afraid to get into hot, super hot, fiery hot, Mozambican spice, peri-peri, whatever you want to call it. That's how it works every single week. The Burning Platform. All right. We'll see you tomorrow, 6 o'clock, bright and early. Otherwise, we'll see you in a week. CliffCentral.com